directly to the front, eh? You can do the final.
You have to be aggressive. If you're not aggressive, you're not in the race.
Is it a little bit uncomfortable that you've got guys that people say, we don't really like the fact that you've got this ex-doper on your team and so on and so forth? Yes, that's extremely uncomfortable.
I'm very busy, but I always find a little bit of time for our listeners, for you.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
And we're joined remotely by Lionel Burney, who's been out in the Quaremont all day. We're in Oudenaarde at the finish of the Tour of Flanders. We've watched Alexander Kristoff of Norway win the race.
There's his press officer just there, Philip Martens. Maybe he can make a...
Maybe get him on the podcast. He's on the phone at the moment. We'll see if we can grab him. But a surprising, for me anyway, surprising manner of victory for Kristoff, not perhaps the fact that he won it. We just heard him in the press conference. We'll hear from him in a moment, talking about how it was his dream to win here, how he was worried that he went a little bit too early with Nicky Terpstra over the top of the Kreuzberg. Terpstra attacked. Kristoff went with him. Speaking to some of our Belgian colleagues, they weren't surprised at that. They thought that he rode very smartly, that he knew that Terpstra was the guy to follow when he went. But Daniel, were you surprised, not so much that Kristoff won, but the way that he won?
Slightly, yeah. I think he played it very well. I think, as we said earlier, that he stayed on the front the whole time, didn't mess around too much. He was aware that Sagan and Van Avermaet could come back. And what was surprising to a lot of people was Terpstra's lack of an attack after the Paterberg. And, I mean, as we'll hear later from Rolf Aldag, who's Etix Quickstep technical manager, they basically were hedging their bets. They hoped that Stibar, who was in the bigger group,
the Danek Stibar,
was in the third group on the road, and they hoped that perhaps Geraint Thomas would counter, and that Stibar could come across with him to Sagan and Van Avermaet and then give them two cards. And even without that, or even if that had happened, you know, they looked like they looked to be in a good position just with Terpstra and Kristoff. But
it continues a barren run for Etix Quickstep. They've been up there in every race, but they're perhaps missing that real talisman, that, you know, leader like a Bonan, Tom Bonan. When he's on fire, you know, the team gathers around him, supports him in the way that we saw Team Sky try to support Geraint Thomas today. You really need an outstanding leader like that.
Yeah, a finisher. I mean, they've got three very strong riders in Vandenberg, Terpstra and Stibar in the absence of Boonen, but none of them were particularly quick, and, you know, that was what undid them today, wasn't it?
It was, absolutely. Well, we'll hear from Alexander Kristoff, who used to live in Oudenaarde as a junior, used to ride the Tour of Flanders course, used to ride it ahead of the race, in fact. And then we'll hear from Geraint Thomas, who had a disappointing day, didn't quite have the firepower he felt that he had the previous week, especially winning E3 Harelbeke, but also finishing third in Gent-Wevelgem.
They seemed to burn quite a lot of matches quite early in the race, around the sort of 100 kilometres to go mark, didn't they, Sky?
Sky set out their stall, didn't they? They rode this race in the way that they have sometimes ridden races that they've targeted, like the British, the Olympic road race, like Copenhagen. They seem to have whether it be Great Britain or Sky, they have a style of riding, of supporting somebody, which is to stack the front, to really try and control the race. And they always seem to do it from a long way out, you know. And I just wonder today, we're talking on Sunday, it was an anarchic, chaotic race without Boonen, without Cancellara. There was a bit of a vacuum there, and I wonder if they just held back a bit, whether it might have played better for them. We're just watching, approaching Ciro Scognamiglio. The main man, Ciro from Gazzetta dello Sport. Welcome.
Do you want to interview me maybe after the race?
You're a bit late for the press conference.
Yes, but I'm never late in my life.
Never?
No, never.
Ciro, what did you make of that race?
Nothing special. I mean, no. Because also today, I must confess, I was not really concentrated on the race.
What were you concentrating on?
You know, Richard, and also listeners know very well my topics that are always in my head. Hey. Cycling is not in the top 10.
You are here, Ciro, you are here to cover the bike race. Let me tell you something that will appall you. I was speaking to Geraint Thomas after the race, and he was talking about the closing stages. He mentioned, at one point, he said, that Lamprey guy. He meant Filippo Pozzato.
But maybe so, but what did it happen between them? Because I don't understand.
What, did you speak to Pozzato after the stage?
Yes, but he didn't speak about Thomas.
What did he say? How was his race?
He said that, well, in the very last part, it was empty. But maybe at the end, in the sprint, they touched together.
I don't know. No, I was more.
It's really important.
I was more surprised that Geraint Thomas didn't seem to know that it was Filippo Pozzato, who's quite a distinguished sort of rider in the peloton, I would have thought.
Is really famous, Filippo Pozzato?
Not as famous as Ciro Scagno Emilio.
Really in our minds, Ciro.
I mean, I'm more famous than him, I think.
You are now, for sure.
Okay. You've got more chance of getting a contract next year than him, even with those comments about cycling not being in your top 10 priorities.
They're certainly not in people's, are they?
I hope that. I mean, the cycling podcast, normally my chiefs are not listening to. Normally, but we don't know.
They're starting to tune in.
Yes, exactly, they should.
So you're going to be back for Paris-Roubaix next week as well, aren't you, Ciro?
Yes.
Are you going to join us then as well for more sparkling insight?
I hope so. For sure, I will join. Maybe the main reason for which I go to Paris-Roubaix.
Do you have anything at all to tell us about the race today?
I mean, the race, in my opinion, for me, I mean, my bet was Geraint Thomas, as I told you before, so I lost. But I have to say that Mr. Luca Paolini...
Mister,
yes, we had a chat in Oman during the Tour of Oman, and at the middle of February, you know, and he already told me that for him, Christophe would have been better in Flanders than in Sanremo, so he expected this victory, so not really surprising.
Okay, excellent. Well, shall we hear now from the winner, Alexander Christophe? We'll hear from Christophe, and then we'll hear immediately after that from Geraint Thomas, who was disappointed and reflected on a difficult day at the office.
I raced there a lot as a young rider, and I watched this race long before I even had the chance to participate. You know, my dream was actually just to participate, never to win, and now I also won it, so it's a great feeling, and I cannot really describe it. It was the main goal for this part of my season, and to achieve it, the feeling is really great, and I'm really happy. I was a little bit early, I thought, but I didn't want to let him go away because he was going to close it, and he was really strong in the start. We worked really a lot, and we got a good gap. And after a while, I managed to do the rhythm, and I contribute. We were working well, kept the distance quite good. Yeah, at the end, he got on the air that he couldn't work with me, but I said to him, come on, you will worst get second, you know, it's still a good result. And yeah, then he was working again, and of course at the end he wanted to save his legs so we have a chance, but I was pretty confident I will still beat him, but I try not to go really full gas the last 2 kilometers, just save a little bit so I have something left for a sprint, and it was enough. So it was a great feeling when I saw he couldn't pass me.
Geraint, you look exhausted. It was a chaotic race, that. Can you sum up those sort of final 30Ks for us?
Obviously, Flanders hard race. Just lacked that punch, I guess, which I had last week. It felt on Quaremont, and I had to have a go because the boys were just rode so well all day for me. And I just didn't quite have the legs at the end. And I don't know, when you're feeling a bit average, it feels like everyone's sort of following you. But that's to be expected, I guess. And, you know, once I was in that group behind, it was just... I wasn't enjoyable at all. It was just nobody would work together. Everyone was typical sort of big race. You know, everyone was a leader in there. Nobody wanted to really work and just attack after attack. And it was just frustrating. But
Was it a factor that Cancellara and Bonin weren't there?
I don't know. I think if they were there, I think it would have been similar, really. You know, Fabian might have just been up the road with Van Avermaet maybe or something. I don't know. You know, initially when I went, I felt okay, but... you know, when you just know that he's sat on you, the flat part sort of just eased off a bit, and then everyone sort of came up, and yeah, then Pattersberger just lacked that last bit over the top, and that's when Sagan and Van Avermaet went. And then, like I say, once you're stuck in that group behind, then it's especially when you're tired and for me as well, not really having that massive kick. It's hard to get a gap, especially when you know, a couple of guys attack, nobody follows, and then as soon as you make a move, everyone's straight onto you. But you know, maybe it was just because I felt a bit bad that I was sort of reading into it too much, but that's what it kind of felt like on the road. But yeah,
were you surprised to see Christophe go up the road as early as he did, and how impressed are you by his win?
Not really surprised he went when he did, you know, because I think we're expecting moves like that. So when him and Terpstra went and got that gap, it was obviously dangerous, and yeah, a really good move by those two. And yeah, you know, Christophe, he's the last couple of years he's really sort of moved on, and yeah, he was super strong today.
Okay, Daniel, we heard there from Alexander Christophe and Geraint Thomas, but our partner in crime, Lionel Burney, is out on the course today. He's on the Quaremont, the climb, the cobbled climb, and we'll be hearing detailed dispatches from him on the climb in our next Friends special podcast, which should be out next week. And remember, you can become a friend of the podcast for just £5. See thecyclingpodcast.com. But over to you, Lionel.
Thanks, Richard. Well, I'm on the Alder Quaremont where I've been all afternoon. That was the Alexander Christophe fan club, and the leading two riders, who I think are Lars Back and Gouger of AG2R, have just come past. The second time they've come over the Quaremont. One more time to go, of course. And as I said, I've got absolutely no idea what's been going on in the race this afternoon. But clearly those two riders are out in front. Are any of the other breakaway riders just behind them? No, they're not. De Boucher, the Belgian champion, leading a little group there. Matt Heyman of Orica Greenedge. I've no idea if this is... Yeah, this is the peloton. Geraint Thomas on the front there. The race is full on now. Quite an extraordinary sight. Andre Greipel hauling his huge bolt up the climb. Well placed he was. And at the back here, well, not quite the back, but there's a real scrap going on. Riders three abreast across the road. You can tell how much the cobbles are juddering the bikes. Forearms and chins wobbling, or maybe not chins wobbling, but certainly forearms wobbling as they judder over the cobblestones. Anyone this far back is pretty much out of contention, I would say, even though they're in touch with the back of the peloton. They're so far back now. And there goes Matt Bramier, number 201, just off the back of the peloton. He's had quite a day out in the early break, not managed to hang on, obviously, when Lars Back and Gouger made their move, whenever that was. I'm sure Richard and Daniel will be able to fill us in on that. And that is it until the final time round. I think they've got 55 kilometres to go from here. And the final time round will be right at the sharp end of the race.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Van Dessel Cycles. Van Dessel, ride inspired.
So, Daniel, we're still in the sun-kissed Oudenaarde. It wasn't very sort of spring classics weather today, was it?
It was fairly spring-like, wasn't it?
Well, it depends.
It was sunny.
That's Belgium, though.
Okay. Well, you know, I thought it was... Anyway, go on, Rich. Come on, let's have some serious cycling chat now, because it hasn't been enough
Was it a vintage Tour of Flanders?
No, I mean, we talked earlier about how it seems slightly sort of, dare I say, well, we said decaffeinated, a bit low-cal, wasn't it, without Cancellara and Boone. How did Cancellara fare on Twitter, by the way?
I think he was man of the match. He had a great, I mean, the Fabianese, we mentioned this in the Friends of the Cycling Podcast special on the classics, didn't we? The multi-action man of sport, also a multi-action man of Twitter. Mm. He is a class act on Twitter, isn't he?
He really is. But, you know, but going back to the race, Christophe, we said he's, you know, we were surprised by the performance today, but he's, I think he's 28, is he? And maybe he is going to be the next Cancellara or Boone. Maybe he's the emerging, the superpower who is going to win three or four of these in the next few years.
Well, I think it's fair to say we've never seen him win a race like that, really. And I mentioned to you as we were watching him power up the Pattersburg and almost drop Nicky Terpstra, who's obviously a very strong rider in this sort of terrain. You know, a few weeks ago in Milan San Remo, he was struggling on the Cipressa, which is a very different kind of climb. But these are different. These require different efforts. He pushes a huge gear. They're real strongmen climbs, aren't they? And that's what he is. But he reminds me a bit of, a Sean Kelly or a Johan Museo. You know, Johan Museo is perhaps the best template. Somebody who started out as a bunch sprinter, very fast, but evolved into this classics rider in his late 20s, early 30s.
Yeah, and it's interesting that of all the big Norwegian riders, he's probably the one, well, let's say the big three that have emerged in the last few years. So Hushovd and Edvald Boasenhagen and Kristoff, he's probably the one who was the least hyped, wasn't he? And, you know, Tor Hushovd never won a monument. He won the World Championships, but he never won one of these races, despite looking, you know, like he would for a number of years. Boasenhagen is sort of sunk without trace for the moment. He might re-emerge. But I've just seen good friend of the podcast, Anders Christensen from VG, newspaper. Yeah. He will no doubt be very busy today.
Well, we spoke to him, of course, during the Tour de France last year about Kristoff and about the problems, not problems so much, but Kristoff doesn't connect with fans, even in Norway, where they're passionate about their cycling. But here as well, partly perhaps because he rides for the Katusha team, which is a team that also perhaps struggles to connect with people. But he's a very sort of personable, affable guy, but not perhaps all that interesting, dare I say.
He's a bit of a cold fish, isn't he?
He is, but, you know, perhaps, as you say, he is the next sort of champion to emerge. I mean, what other races can he win? He can win Paris-Roubaix, can he not?
Yeah, he certainly can, although, you know, to look at him and the way he rides in his position on the bike, you would think that he would be more suited to Paris-Roubaix than the Tour of Flanders, whereas in actual fact, he has always said that he's preferred the Tour of Flanders, always had better results there. So, you know, obviously he's not going to be riding with any pressure next week, but I think he's less likely to contend there, particularly with the team he has as well. You know, his key domestique this year has been Luca Paolini, who actually today, I suspect, was crucial probably in the first 200 kilometres, but we didn't see...
Why he was riding the cars so much.
Yeah, well, yeah. But we didn't see too much in the finale. But Paolini is not a guy who has even that much experience of Paris-Roubaix. He's only ridden it three or four times. So, yeah, I think we'll see other riders coming to the fore next week.
Now, last week we had a special interview, of course, with Chris Baldwin of Astana. So we didn't really talk about the two of the other cobbled classics, Gent-Wevelgem and E3 Harlbeka, which we should probably mention because Geraint Thomas, his performances in both those races meant that he started as many people's favourite in the Tour of Flanders. I think he was lacking that zip that he had the previous weekend. I spoke to Rod Ellingworth at the 3 days of Dipana, and he had absolute confidence that Thomas would maintain his form through Flanders and Roubaix. He didn't see that it'd be a problem at all. He and Dave Brailsford both said they thought that he was the strongest guy in the peloton at the moment. But, you know, we mentioned earlier, Sky rode the race in a certain way. They really set out their stall, and Thomas ultimately didn't quite have it, did he?
No, he did look like the strongest rider in the race, probably up until the last time at the Paterberg. I mean, the Quaremont, even the last time up there, he looked very strong. Yeah, he didn't have much support in the finale. Luke Rowe had done brilliantly.
Kristoff had Luca Paolini. Thomas had Luca Rowe.
Very good, Richard. Very good.
Well, listen, I mentioned I spoke to Rod Ellingworth. Let's hear from Rod Ellingworth, because I reflected with him that the first three cobbled classics of the season, Het Nieuwsblad, Kerner Brussels Kerner, and E3 Harlbeke, were all won by riders coached by him and products of the British Academy, which he used to run, namely Ian Stannard, Mark Cavendish, and Geraint Thomas. So here was Rod Ellingworth reflecting on the coming of age of that golden generation.
It's brilliant, really. You know, they are coming of age, and I think certainly at these one-day races, which takes time to, you know, you have to develop into this role that they are. You've got to get to know the roads. And I just think if you think of now all the classics that's happened, we've had three British winners, three different British winners of some of the best bike races in the world. You know, we've obviously got the two big cobble classics to come, but we're in a really good place. So I think when you think of that opening weekend of the classics with Ian winning Nieuwsblad and then Cav winning Kern. I think it's fantastic for British cycling, and you know, and then as you say, you know, Luke's coming on really well. Swifty, you know, he's right there.
But one of the things that you were always that you drilled into them, these guys, from when they were teenagers, was how to race. We've known that these physically had the talent. Is it satisfying for you to see them also, especially in Stannard's when it hit Newsblad? Yeah. A real sort of tactical masterclass, Geraint Thomas as well.
Yeah, no, I think they've done really well. And you know, when I first started working in British cycling, that's what I recognised, was we were fast, but none of these guys could race. We weren't very good at team at Madison's or points races or scratch races, and that was one of my main objectives, was to change that. So going right back to the day of these coach-led racing sessions, which was all about teaching the guys tactics, all these lads were on there. You know, every single one of them, you Adam Blives, you Alex Dowsis, and you know, all them lads were involved, even though at that time they were still schoolboys, you know, they weren't even juniors, you know. So I think from an early age, they've learned tactically, and I would say some of them lads are as good as anybody out there tactically. So it's good to see, you know, it's brilliant to be involved in, and I've been fortunate, obviously, to follow some of these lads from when they were young lads all the way through to now they're, you know, full time. Doing what they want to do, their parents and full adults and having a damn good life, you know.
I mean, it's funny because, you know, when you ran the British Academy, you were known as quite a disciplinarian. You could be quite hard on them. You know, you're still looking after the likes of Geraint Thomas. How has your relationship with them changed over the years?
Well, I think, you know, you do have to learn to understand when they become adults and when they take responsibility. You know, we were fortunate enough, I've been fortunate enough to work with people like Steve Peters to help me understand when that moment is with some of these guys. And I think something I've always tried to do, though, is always, it is about their career, not my career, and give them the responsibility of taking on the training, and they lead their own training, I advise and help them and guide them, you know. But so yeah, relationship changes, but I still think they know where the line is with me. I think they do, you know, and ultimately somebody has to have a say. But I think we've developed really good close relationships, that we have very open conversations. So there's no need; they don't have to hide anything from me, I don't think. They perhaps do.
So there's no punishment essays or anything like that.
Sure, no, none of them anymore. No, gone at the time of that stuff. But yeah, you know, when you look back, I mean, they all have a laugh about it now, you know. But I think they respect the time that I put into it with them, and you know, I'm still there with them, and still doing sessions with them here and there, and spending many hours on the motorbike with them sometimes in the rain, and you know, and enjoying
Luke,
it.
And Luke, we're talking before the Tour of Flanders, and Geraint Thomas would be one of the favourites for that race. But then Paris-Roubaix, of course, a massive target for Bradley Wiggins, but you've got Ian Stannard, Thomas as well.
Yeah.
Is it a strength to have so many different cars to play?
Well,
over one leader.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, and I mean, we will go in with a plan. I think quite often we go into races with a double hit, if you like. In near enough every race we do, you try and have a plan A and a plan B, so we'll pretty much do the same, hopefully. I would say all the lads are looking pretty good, and you know, Ian's had a tough time since Milan San Remo with his crash, but yesterday was the first time he felt pretty good again, you know. So hope, you know, fingers crossed, we've got everything to play for, haven't we? We shall see. It'll be pretty exciting.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Join us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast.
The women's Tour of Flanders, which started and finished in Oudenaarde, was won by Elisa Longo-Borghini of Italy, ahead of her Wingle Honda teammate, the Belgian national road race champion Jolien Duhr. The race was not televised live, sadly, which made it very difficult to follow. And after the race, I spoke about that issue to Laura Winter of Vox Women, the new internet channel which is reporting on and filming at all the major women's races this year. You can hear the interview with Laura in our Next Friends special. But at the finish, I also spoke to Giorgia Bronzini of Wiggle Honda, and here she is. Great day for your team and your countrywoman, Elisa Longo-Borghini.
Yeah, of course. We plans try to help Elisa and Jolien, and that was the plans and was perfect. We say two names, and it was first and second. All the team do a great job to cover the attack and try to relax the legs in the in the first part of the race, and we work hard in the second part, and we give everything for the mate, and that is teamwork.
So she went with about 30 kilometres to go, a long way out. Was the plan for her to have a go and for Yulin to hold back and, you know, obviously be there for the sprint if it came down to that?
No, we just say to Elisa to attack when she feel like, and I say to her to follow the instinct. In one race like Flandre, you can't plan where you can attack, so you must feed your legs, your instinct, and I say to her to attack and don't look it back. She do that, and obviously if someone else was with her, maybe she stop and she attacking all the time, so she's clever enough. But I think today she won because she was brave.
You've been on this team since the start. Is this the best day that you've had? You've obviously won a lot of races yourself, but does it feel good today to be part of a team that's finished 1-2 in this race?
Of course. I was in agree with Roche Guillemot to make a stronger team as possible, to have it with a good balance, because I would like that the team going to win all kind of races, and we did it until now, so it's perfect.
Now, we weren't able to watch the women's race at all. I think we'll be able to see highlights of it later, but there's been a lot of comments from people angry that they weren't able to even watch the finish of the women's race. Does it make you angry that that's still the case, that there's not live television coverage?
Yeah, it's a little bit sad that, because I think that the show of today was a really good show, and the people, of course, will enjoy to see our race, so it's a little bit sad. But we are working on to have more kind of respect and to give to the people a good show. So we are working on, and already we have a lot than before, but we still have to fight.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast and British Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Thank you once again to our sponsors, Van Dessel Cycles and British Eurosport, whose jingle you heard there, the home of cycling, British Eurosport. Big thank you to them, and also to the friends of the podcast, whose support means that we are able to be here. The Tour of Flanders covering this race will be at Pirate Bay as well, and hopefully all the major races this season. Just a reminder that coming up on British Eurosport over the coming week are from the 6th to 11th of April, so as we speak, the Tour of the Basque Country is on. And on Sunday, of course, it's Paris-Roubaix.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.
Okay, Daniel, you've got to rush off to catch your train home very soon. But you spoke to a couple people at the finish, as did I, and I'll introduce mine to you in a moment. But who did you speak to?
Germans, only Germans, strictly Germans today. So I spoke to John Degenkolb's dad. That was in German, but not for the podcast, unfortunately. Degenkolb himself, we're going to hear from briefly. He was very happy with his team's performance. He feels like he's really progressed compared to last year. He struggled in the closing stages last year. Today, really, he just lacked a couple of, well, strong guys on other teams, really, to bring that third group on the road back to the leaders. But he was fairly happy. This is me talking to John Degenkolb outside the giant Alpecin bus as he warmed down this evening.
You got very close in that group at the end to getting back to Sagan Van Avermaet. Was it lack of collaboration or lack of legs in that group?
I think my legs were still good, and it was basically not lucky constellation of the riders which were in front, and the riders were in my group, so nobody really wanted to pull, and I was working actually pretty a lot to let the group run, and G was also riding pretty hard, and yeah, that's in the end not up to us, and we can't change it anymore, so I'm happy to got a top 10 result.
And you just said you're very happy with the team performance and the progress you've made as a team this year in the classics.
Absolutely. I mean, we're riding really close together all the time, and make a good plan before. And yeah, the riders are like growing and getting better and better every year. That's nice to see.
The final German that I spoke to today was Rolf Aldag, who is the technical manager at Etix Quickstep, and he gave a very detailed analysis of Nicky Terpstra's tactics in the finale, and in particular why he didn't attack Alexander Kristoff as they rode into the last 10 kilometers alone.
The problem was, like, if we would have Stebe had in the group with Van Avermaet and Sagan, then we could have gambled. Then it was easy for Stebe just to stay on the wheel and just to stay, and also to ask Nicky not to pull anymore. But that scenario was kind of like, okay, then they're with four, and what will happen?
Yeah.
We had something similar last year with... 2 years ago in the news, but when Paulini won and Steen van den Berg was second, that you have to look then to say, well, out of that situation, what can we do? We ride for the win, but if there's no way for the win anymore, then, you know, we have to kind of like try to get the best out of it. And that possibility to beat Kristoff in the sprint wasn't really that big. But Nicky did do exactly the right thing. I mean, when he was kind of sure to say, well, we get for the line and at least they can sprint for the win, and maybe he's also as tired as he looks like, then he still has a chance. But like right now, we just have to say the strongest guy won.
Yeah, I mean, everyone watching, everyone knowing Nicky thought that he would maybe go with a kilometer to go, but it was perhaps not strong enough on the day.
You can always go from a kilometer out of group of 4 or 5 and then hope that they don't react, but going from a kilometer out of a two-man group, that's also kind of hopeless. So I think then he decided to say, well, I save, and I just gamble on, like, keep the pressure a little bit up by the guys coming from behind, and he has to ride some tempo, and let's see what I can do in the sprint against him. And yeah, sometimes you never know with Nicky. He can pull something out that he's surprised about. No, out of the situation, honestly. We only had two guys in that group at that stage, while others had four. And if you're once on your back foot, tactically, to say others go and you have to ride, then you're completely lost in space. You know, then you have three teammates on the wheel, and once you catch one back, the next guy goes. So Nicky is always really good in doing that, like really getting the situation first from the whole group, and then doing the move that he has to do. Sometimes you're really surprised that the group like that allows him to go away. Because obviously, I mean, he won Roubaix, he won Waregem, he won a lot of races that way, and he still gets away with it. So I think he exactly understands what to do if the situation is like it is.
And then when the two were gone, what was the plan then? What was the idea?
Well, the idea was the idea was basically to cover the counterattacks by Stieber, and he could do it till Patersberg. Basically, he was with Geraint Thomas then on top of Quaremont, and for him it's also super tricky. What does he do? Yeah. Normally, you were thinking, well, if the gap would be bigger, he probably should ride with him till they make sure they're clear of the rest of the group, and then sit up and then say, so now it's up to you to close the last 15 seconds. So if Terpstra and would have had, let's say, 45 seconds, then Stebe could also play. Then he could go with Gerrans full gas, you know, bring it down to 25 seconds, make sure the group behind is 20 seconds, and then sit up and wait and make him riding. If they come back, he's the freshest. If they don't, well, he puts the pressure definitely on Kristoff, and Nicky can take it easy. And now the situation was just like Nicky knew two super fast guys coming also from behind, and that isn't the best, obviously.
But with Nicky and Kristoff in front, was there the hope that Kristoff would maybe, you know, could be dropped by Nicky on one of those last two climbs?
Yeah, of course, the hope is always there, and that dies last. But if we've seen it, that's why I said initially to take the best one won, because at the end of the day, it turns out that on the Patersberg, even Kristoff seems to have more horsepower than Nicky had. It wasn't really that you would have said, like, ooh, now Kristoff is in trouble. He wasn't, which was kind of also expected, because if you've seen him, how he was in the Panne, and then how strong he was in that time trial, you would not really expect him to fade.
Yeah.
It was an interesting race, and you've seen, ultimately, the favorites, no matter what weather condition, they're still there, and they still do it in between them. So it's no really big surprises at the end of the day.
And all your guys were on a reasonable day. There was no one who said they, you know, didn't have good legs today, or they were as they should be.
No. I mean, there's nobody to blame. Of course, we would have hoped in that group with Stieber and Terpstra to have one to two more guys, but then you go into the bus and you see Stijn Vandenberg with a swollen nose because he did run into a tree. He crashed another time. You see Matteo Trentin crashing at the foot of the Koppenberg. And then there are good reasons why they haven't been there, because if you look at the first Corporate Classics, we've always been the strongest as a collective. And this time we had four guys of Astana, four guys of BMC, three guys of Lotto, and only two guys of us. So, you know, you would think like, what was that? But then you realize that it was extremely bad luck. And that obviously is something that you just can influence.
Right, we better wrap up there, Daniel. Thank you very much. Hope you've enjoyed your Tour of Flanders and the podcasting. We did also record today our Friends Special podcast, which will be completed at Paris-Roubaix next week. It'll be part Flanders, part Chel de Prisse, which I'm going to midweek, and part Paris-Roubaix. But thank you very much, Daniel, and good luck catching your train.
Thank you. It's been breathless, I feel, hasn't it? You
know, it has. We'll get our breath back this week and come back, do it again next week.
Okay.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.